Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Friday, September 23rd, 2016. I'm your host, Scott Burton, in for Andy Klein. On today's show, we'll talk with Pat McClear about Family Promise of Juno and Sunday's fundraiser. We'll get a preview of Friday night's Evening at Egan presentation with guests Jan and John Straley. We'll hear some highlights from Modest Yahoo's evening at the Gold Town Theater last night. And we'll talk with author McKibben Jakinski. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno afternoon, currently 53 degrees at the Juno Airport.
With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonia Gonzalez. A controversial bill involving the Bears Ears region of Utah is headed to a full House vote after it passed the House Natural Resources Committee Thursday. The Public Lands Initiative is backed by Utah Republican Representatives Rob Bishop and Jason Chaffetz. It would protect a portion of the Bears Ears area, which several tribes say is sacred and historically significant. But the bill also opens up a large stretch of land to oil and gas development. The proponents say the bill best represents local and state interests. The Navajo Nation and several other tribes have joined together to oppose the bill. They want President Barack Obama to use the Antiquities Act to designate nearly 2 million acres of the Bears Ears land a national monument. There is no Senate version of the bill yet. Just as Native American groups brace for an extended fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline, some 50 Aboriginal groups from the U.S. and Canada are joining forces to oppose the distribution of oil from Alberta's oil sands. Dan Karpinchuk reports the group signed a treaty against any further oil development.
The treaty was signed in Montreal and Vancouver by tribal leaders from eastern and western Canada, along with some from the northern U.S. They want to stop pipeline projects connected to the oil sands, and those include proposals from Kinder Morgan, Energy East, Northern Gateway, and Keystone XL. The dozens of First Nations say they're making this unprecedented agreement to work together to protect each other and the environment. Judy Wilson is a chief from British Columbia.
No more harm to Mother Earth, no more harm to our water, no more harm to our salmon, no more harm to our way of life as Indigenous people.
The group say they will prohibit and challenge the use of their lands for expanded production of the oil sands, and while the goal is to remain peaceful, all options will be on the table. Serge Simon is the Grand Chief of the Ganasatagi Mohawks in Quebec.
We're going to support and protect each other. We're going to use whatever resources and whatever peaceful means we have at our disposal, and we're going to help stop the pipelines.
The oil industry says it's working with Indigenous people to help get their product to market and hopes a broader dialogue emerges from this cross-border treaty. The Alberta government did not respond, and Ottawa would only say it's committed to working with Native people on a renewed nation-to-nation relationship. I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
An Alaska Native from Yakutat is one of the seven in the remake of the new film The Magnificent Seven. It's Martin Sensmeyer's biggest movie role so far and a long way from his tiny hometown on the Gulf of Alaska. Scott Burton from KTOO reports.
Took a job, looking for some men to join.
Is it difficult? Impossible.
Sensmeyer is on the big screen with a host of A-list actors, including Denzel Washington, Chris Pratt, Ethan Hawke, and Vincent D'Onofrio. One of the most challenging things about taking on the role of Red Harvest, Sensmeyer says, was learning to ride horses.
Being clinging in that basket, you know, I didn't grow up on them, right? So they sent us to Louisiana like a month before filming, and we started, you know, training 5 days a week on horseback riding, about an hour and a half to 2 hours a day. And, you know, I was riding bareback in the movie, but I'm the only one that didn't have a saddle.
Sensmeyer grew up in Yakutat and enjoyed playing basketball and subsistence fishing and hunting. As an adult, he worked on an oil rig at one point. He now divides his time between Los Angeles and Yakutat, working as an actor and model. Even though he's not Comanche, he says he can relate to his character.
We all have similar experiences in terms of what we went through, colonization, but also there's a lot of similarities between the cultural values.
When the 32-year-old Sensmeyer is not acting, he visits home often.
I'm very blessed to be in this position, but I would much rather live at home in Yakutat than in Los Angeles. I'm not really a city boy. I like being in the village.
The movie that opens this week is a remake of the iconic 1960 Western version with Yul Brynner, Steve McQueen, and Charles Bronson. For National Native News, I'm Scott Burton, reporting from Juneau.
And I'm Art Hughes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Since 1970, NARF has stood firm for justice in Indian country on critical issues like treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Friday, September 23rd, 2016. Scott Burton, your host. I've been joined in the studio by Pat McClear. Among other things in our community, she is a volunteer for the Family Promise of Juno. And she's here to tell us about what the Family Promise of Juno is and also about an important fundraiser this Sunday at Northern Light from 5 to 7. Welcome to the show, Pat.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Yeah, start us off. Family Promise of Juno, it's a fairly new organization, right?
We have been meeting for the past 2 years to try to get this up and running. And what this is it's a response to the significant homeless problem in Juno. And it addresses specifically children and their families who are experiencing temporary homelessness. And it's hopefully a sustainable response to help them. Currently, the school district has as many as 240 students are homeless at some point during the school year.
240?
That's a big number.
Here in Juneau.
That's a big number. That's a big number. From what Pastor Terry Stage Harvey has reported, she gets weekly calls from school counselors saying, are you up and running yet? Are you up and running yet? Are you up and running yet? St. Vincent de Paul has an average of 120 people on the wait list for their family shelter. That's that's 10-month wait that they currently have. So the need is great. And so the local faith communities, this is an interfaith collaboration to try to provide a safe space for, as I said, children and their families. So the families are interviewed, and then they are housed for 1 week at a time at a local church. So they might start, let's say, at Shepherd of the Valley. They're there for a week. And then the following week, the cots and the bedding and everything is packed up, and they're delivered to yet another church. Currently, there are 10 faith communities that have signed up to host. We are in need of 3 more to be able to have the right numbers to get this to work. Each faith community is asked to house once each quarter.
And would that faith community need, I'm assuming, a building or a church?
Correct.
Of some kind?
So those of us who do not have either a that we rent, like my fellowship, the Juno Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, we rent from the Congregation Sukkot Shalom at the temple. But the temple can't house either. That's just not big enough. So both of our communities, along with a handful of others, will be support communities, so that if a family is, say, at Northern Light United Church, then one of our communities would be there in the evenings to help with supper, to play Yahtzee, to help with homework, to read books, to talk about the daily news, you know, whatever.
Okay. And you were saying that, let's think of a family, let's say they are staying at Northern Light.
Mm-hmm.
Where do they go during the day? Do they stay at the church? Or
they do not. The church, Northern Light, is a great example. It's a community center. There are folks in and out of there all day long. And that happens, I know, at several other churches in town as well. So what we will hope to establish within the next probably 4 months or so is a day center. So the family will be transported to the day center. The adults will... We will have an executive director with whom the adults will meet and get assistance with housing and job employment opportunities. Non-school age, children who are school age will be going to school, and the younger ones would be in a safe daycare situation.
Okay. And all along, you were saying you are looking for more sustainable housing for them.
Correct.
What are some examples of how you do that?
Well, that's why we'll have an executive director who will hopefully have her or his finger on the pulse in terms of what's available in town and how to get folks to do it.
And as you develop Family Promise of Juno.
Yes, yes, okay. Yes, yeah.
And so this Sunday, you'll be at Northern Light United
Church,
right?
We will, from 5 to 7 p.m. at Northern Light United Church, yet again extending hospitality to the community. We will be having a halibut supper and a silent auction with a suggested donation of $20. And if I can tip the scales here a little bit, some of the silent auction items are quite nice. There's two Wings Taku Lodge trips. There's up to 40,000 Alaska Airlines miles. There's a condo for 1 week in Maui. There's a fried chicken dinner donated by Margaret Pugh. And if anybody's had the pleasure of being seated at the Pugh household to eat this fried chicken, you'll want to show up and put a bid. And I am also a member of the Juno Community Garden, and we will be donating harvest baskets of recently harvested potatoes, garlic, Swiss chard, kale, beets, jams, and jellies, good things like that. So and desserts. There's a big PS there. And desserts, capital D.
Pat, I can tell you've put a lot of time into Family Promise of Juno. You're a volunteer. Why are you passionate about fighting homelessness, especially in families and children?
When I was made aware of those numbers, the weekly phone calls, do you have space? We have kids who are couch surfing. We have families in their cars. We have families in their vans. And having been a member of the Juno School District, working there for 20-odd years, the thought of those, when you get up in the morning and you're rummaging around in the back seat of the car trying to find something to wear, that you don't have an opportunity to bathe, to wash, to brush your teeth, that you come to school and you're hungry and you smell, and you don't know where your next meal is coming from. You add that all up, and you get students who, under different circumstances, could be very productive. But they're tired, they're hungry, and they're scared. And it's really hard to do your job as a student when you're not being cared for. So the bottom line for me is that these children need a safe space, and the adults in their lives need assistance to be able to better care for the children that they love.
Okay. We were speaking earlier a little bit about Housing First, the Housing First facility, 32-unit facilities being built in Lemon Creek right now. And that's certainly a step forward.
Absolutely.
This is different, though. Like you said, this is families and children. So this is also a significant step forward.
Correct. So we're not speaking about single individuals. We are talking about children with their families.
You said that you could use three more faith communities.
Yes, absolutely, to make the numbers more viable.
All right. If one of these communities or a person in this community, one of those wanted to learn more, how should they do that?
Family Promise of Juno has a web page, familypromiseofjuno.org, and we also have a Facebook page, Family Promise of Juno. And you could also contact Reverend Stage Harvey at Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church.
Or you can come to the fundraiser
and come to the
talk
fundraiser
to you
and
directly.
We will be wearing name tags. We'll be wearing shirts. I don't know what else they'll be dressing us up as, so that there'll be members of the Family Promise team seated at every table to play 20 questions with whomever wants to ask them.
And just to highlight again, you are now a nonprofit and you're growing. You're hoping to hire an executive director and keep on your efforts to fight
Absolutely.
Homelessness.
And the goal right now, Scott, is that in 2017 we will open.
Okay.
Yep.
Pat McClure. She's with Family Promise of Juneau. They have a fundraiser Sunday at Northern Light United Church from 5 to 7 p.m. Pat, thank you for coming on the show.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
That you're wearing, but it's cold, cold in there. Fish, they be swimming in and out your toes, staring up at your painted flesh, but it's cold, cold in there. I feel myself leave, and when I'm gone, lilacs on the ashes of the sun, on the way to the sea, forgotten Aberdeen. I read the message was, deliver my peace.
That right there was Deliver My Peace by Dave McGraw and Mandy Fair. They're playing at the Goldtown Theater on October 5th. They're a Pacific Northwest songwriter duo. So tickets will go on sale soon at KTOO.org. You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon, by the way, here on Friday, September 23rd, 2016. Scott Burton, your host, in for Andy Klein. And speaking of duos, in the studio now with me is editor Jan Straley and author John Straley. Jan, you're probably an author too. Welcome to the show, you two.
Thank you so much.
It's nice to have you. And you will be presenting this evening at Evening at Egan about Ed Ricketts from Cannery Row to Sitka, Alaska. A really interesting story. Jan, why don't we start with you? What inspired the creation of this collection?
Well, for me, this book was inspired by an essay that was written by Ed Ricketts called The Wave Shock. We call it the Wave Shock Essay, but its actual title is, let me read it because it really describes the title, but it's a little clumsy and it's a little long, but it does tell you what's. So here's the title. This is the original title. Notes and Observations, Mostly Ecological, Resulting from Northern Pacific Collecting Trips, Chiefly in Southeastern Alaska, with a special reference to wave shock as a factor in littoral ecology. Basically, all catchy. So we call it the Wave Shock Essay because it's an essay about how animals live in a tide pool depending on how the waves impact their tide pool. So animals with a lot of waves have a specific characteristic, and animals that don't have very much wave shock at all in their tide pools live a different life. So it's a really different way of looking at how animals are organized on a beach. So before 1932, when they actually took this trip up to Sitka and through the Inside Passage, it was a lot of putting animals in boxes by their taxonomy rather than looking at how they lived their life in a tide pool. So
Ed Ricketts, very influential on the science side of things, but also literarily, if you will, right? Mm-hmm. Just in case somebody doesn't know, John, tell us about why Ed Ricketts is important.
Well, Ed Ricketts was a scientist in Monterey, California. He moved there in the 20s. And later in the 20s, John Steinbeck moved to Monterey. It was an amazing scene in the 20s and 30s. In that there was great food from the sea and from the farming communities up north. There was great wine from the wineries that came down. There was a nice climate, and it had been a vacation spot for people from San Francisco, and there were a lot of cheap bungalows to live in. So artists flocked there from all over the world, and Steinbeck came there. He had just, of course, lived up in Salinas. But Ricketts came there to work on a collection business where he collected marine samples and sold them to schools. But other artists like John Cage, who has an interesting Juneau connection, Jack Calvin, who was from Sitka, Edward Weston, the great black and white photographer. And
all the Kashavarov
daughters. And all the Kashavarov daughters. We were just over at the museum today, which is named for
their grandfather.
Their grandfather. And Jack Calvin, who later moved to Sitka, was married to Sasha Kashavarov. And so there was all this fascinating group of people. Steinbeck fell in love with the scene, and he wrote Cannery Row about Doc Ricketts. And Ricketts, a real person, became the subject of John Steinbeck's literature. John Steinbeck wrote Cannery Row and then Sweet Thursday, two best-selling novels. Cannery Row was an iconic novel of place, really. And then he wrote, after Ricketts died, he wrote a long essay called About Ed Ricketts at the beginning of The Log of the Sea of Cortez. So Ricketts... most people know Ed Ricketts as a literary character.
As Doc in those books.
But in 1932, they made a trip up the Inside Passage to Sitka and then over to Juneau because Sasha wanted to visit her family. Zenya, who later married John Cage, who was the great American composer, she married John Cage. Years after that, 5 years or so after that, their marriage, he came out of the closet, and he was a homosexual, and one of the great collaborators in modern music and contemporary dance with Merce Cunningham. They changed American theater completely, and for a time, Cage lived in Juneau with Zenya, who's buried here in Juneau.
A lot of connections.
Yeah, a lot of connections.
Yes, it's kind of crazy.
Jan, what impresses you most about Ed, or, you know, hearing from all these collaborators that submitted essays for this book and that you probably solicited, were you able to gain new perspectives or respect for him?
I was. It was pretty incredible. Everybody I asked to do an essay just said yes immediately, even though there was really no monetary gain for anybody out of this project. And the Nancy lives in Sitka, and the son, Ed Jr., lives in Marin County, and I visited both of them and asked the permission to use the essay. It had never been published before, and that was the driving force for this, is to get this essay out into the world, because nobody had seen it. In fact, somebody that had done their PhD in the 60s in off Washington coast had studied some of the same wave impact. I asked him to review the book, and he had never even heard of the essay. Yeah, it was pretty amazing. So
it must feel fulfilling to get it out there.
It is, but it was never going to be a full scientific peer-reviewed piece of scientific writing because Ed had never finished it. And then also it wasn't really designed in today's standards for quantitative data analysis. So it's a bit qualitative. It's still a fascinating read, and it really is insightful for 1932. And so I thought it was really necessary to get it out there. But to really get it out there in a book, it needed to be bracketed in context. And so that's why we had Nancy write an essay about collecting with her family. And Ed's biography, Katie Roger, wrote an essay about Ed as a science writer, because he never really thought of himself as a writer. But he really was a pretty good writer. And John wraps it up with a really nice piece on the charisma of place.
So it sounds like to me that this would be very readable for anybody. You know, it's a nice collaboration of literature and science.
It is. It works really well. And I think the way it's structured, even though you might be a little afraid of the science in the middle of it, that's where the wave shock essay is, I think by the time you get there, you have a good appreciation for what it's all about.
And it reflects Ricketts himself, who is a man of great passion, and who loved art and music and history and philosophy and very dedicated his life to science. So this book has equal parts of science, art, memoir, history.
And you're one of the collaborators, right?
Uh-huh. Jan asked me to write an essay, and I wrote the ending essay.
Would you mind reading a portion for us?
I can read the first start. Thank you. If I understand the foundation of what Ed Ricketts and Jack Calvin, Sasha Calvin, and Joseph Campbell were contemplating as they were working their way up the coast on board the Grampus in 1932, simply put, it was this, that place shapes life. If this is so, what clues do these words give us to the lives that must have been found in the bustling little community of Monterey, California, the place where it all started? And this is a quotation from the beginning of Cannery Row. Cannery Row in Monterey, California is a poem, a stink, a grating noise, a quality of light, a tone, a habit, a nostalgia, a dream. Cannery Row is the gathered and scattered tin and iron and rust and splintered wood, chipped pavement and weedy lots and junk heaps, sardine canneries of corrugated iron, honky-tonks, restaurants and whorehouses, little crowded groceries and laboratories and flop houses. Its inhabitants are, as the man once said, whores, pimps, gamblers, and sons of bitches, by which he meant everybody. Had the man looked through the other people, he might have said saints and angels and martyrs and holy men, and it would have meant the same thing. Clearly, Cannery Row, through the eyes of John Steinbeck at least, was a culture made up of sensual beings who valued freedom over status. This was a culture newly built, full of flaws, mistakes, and promise. This was the American West. So that Steinbeck was a romantic writer, and he made this beautiful world, as a fiction writer can and does, larger than life. And he made Ed Ricketts larger than life. And this, our book, is a little corrective to that, in that it delves into the hard science. It also delves into the other picture of Ricketts that was never mentioned, was that he was a good father to his daughters. And he was a loving man, a smart man. And his daughter, Nancy, who was 91 years old, and I wish she were here with us today, but she wasn't feeling well, but she wanted the world to know about how dearly she treasured her father's mind. And that was completely left out of Steinbeck's telling of the doc.
Yeah. You wouldn't know he had any kids looking at the John Steinbeck's book. So,
Jan, what can participants, the audience, expect tonight?
Well, we're going to give an overview of the book and basically what we talked about today in more depth. And we're going to have some nice slides, some photographs that have never been published before that were in Nancy's possession. So we're going to just show what the family, a lot of some family photos, and photos of the early life in Monterey Bay, and then bring it up to what the science is doing today.
And we'll be talking about the relationship between Cannery Row in the 30s, that romantic, almost heroic era, and we'll talk about the similarities between that time and place and the current time and place in southeastern Alaska. Nancy, who's 91, says southeastern Alaska reminds her of Cannery Row back in the 30s. And we have some pictures that illustrate that. And it's mostly the spirit of the people, the artists and the artists, the writers, the scientists, all with rubber boots on, all wanting to get out into the wild.
This was published by Shorefast right here in Juneau.
Right here in Juneau, right. And the graphic artist and the was from Juneau, Sarah Asper Smith, and also the artist who did the illustrations is from Sitka.
Norm Campbell did a wonderful job, and Soho Press is the perfect fit. Shorefast is the perfect fit for this story because they're dedicated to authentic Alaskan fact and holding on to that in our collective memory.
And that's Katrina Pearson, right? That runs Shorefest.
Right. And Ben did the redid all the photographs.
Ben Huff, yeah.
Right. He did a great job.
As we close here, Jan, what are you most proud of with this publication?
I'm proud of what a strong collaboration it was and how everybody just jumped right on board and everybody did their best. Everybody gave it 150%, which was really fun to see. It was a beautiful book.
All right. Jan and John Straley will be presenting this evening at Evening at Egan, which is out at the University of Alaska Southeast, out there at Auk Lake, Auk Bay. It's free to the public. It starts at 7 p.m. It sounds like a very enlightening evening. Ed Ricketts from Cannery Row to Sitka, Alaska. Thank you both so much for coming on the show. Are we missing anything you'd like to add?
I don't think so.
Thanks, Scott. It was great.
Great. Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 23rd of September, 2016. It's the birthday of the poet Yaroslav Seifert, the only Czech to receive the Nobel Prize in Literature, born in a suburb of Prague in 1901. Came from a working-class family, became a journalist and a poet, was a devoted communist when the party first formed after World War I. But as a poet, he represented the poetist movement, which believed that art had no function other than art itself. He objected to the Bolshevik sympathies of the Communist Party in Czechoslovakia, for which he was expelled from the Communist Party. And 2 years later, 1950, a collection of his poems expressing his disillusionment with communism was censured. He survived the Nazi occupation, the Stalinist regime, communist oppression, continued writing and collecting cactus plants until he died in 1986. It's the birthday of the author of The Scarlet Pimpernel, the Baroness Emushka Orczy, born at her family's estate in Hungary, 1865, part of the landed nobility. A novel about a swashbuckling Englishman, Sir Percy Blakeney, who helped his aristocratic brethren in France escape during the French Revolution. It's the birthday of the Roman Emperor Caesar Augustus, born in 63 BC, the great nephew of Julius Caesar, who became Caesar's heir upon his assassination. Augustus, widely respected during his reign. He did good works. He started the first police and firefighting services. He distributed funds for soldiers and veterans, restored temples of Roman deities. The month of August is named in his honor. And it's the birthday of the Mongol Emperor Kublai Khan, born somewhere in Mongolia in 1215, who ruled over most of modern-day Mongolia and China. Marco Polo met Kublai Khan when he traveled from Venice to Mongolia and stayed 17 years there, learned the language, served in Kublai Khan's administration. And from Marco Polo's accounts, we know that Kublai Khan fathered 22 sons by his four wives and 25 sons with other women, and presumably many daughters as well. Here's a poem for today by Linda Hasselstrom, Clara in the Post Office. I keep telling you I'm not a feminist. I grew up an only child on a ranch, so I drove tractors, learned to ride. When the truck wouldn't start, I went to town for parts. The man behind the counter told me I couldn't rebuild a carburetor. I could. Every carburetor on the place. That's necessity, not feminism. I learned to do the books after my husband left me, and the debts and the children. I shoveled snow and pitched hay when the hired man didn't come to work. I learned how to pull a calf when the vet was too busy. As I thought, the cow did most of it herself. They've been birthing alone for 10,000 years. Does that make them feminists? It's not that I don't like men. I love them when I can. But I've stopped counting on them to change my flats or open my doors. That's not feminism. That's just good sense. A poem by Linda Hasselstrom, Clara in the Post Office, from her collection Roadkill, published by Spoon River Publishing and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to calculate baseline scores and training programs with 50 challenging brain games. Learn more at lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Are you ready to start a career where you can earn great wages and benefits while learning a high-demand skill? Apply for an apprenticeship in electrical, power lineman, or telecommunications, and earn while you learn. For more information, call the IBEW office in Juneau at 586-3050 or visit online at alaskaelectricalapprenticeship.com. Applications are being accepted until October 25th.
Sometimes I lay under the moon, I think I'm breathing. Then I pray, don't take me soon, I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds...
You're listening to the music of Modest Yahoo. This is One Day Live. Modest Yahoo's playing tonight at Centennial Hall at 7 p.m., The show is sold out, though Nancy DeCherney from the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council has said that a wait list will start at 6:30 p.m., and she's hoping to get everyone in. The concert, of course, is a collaboration with the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, KRNNKXLL, and us, KTOO. Last night, KTOO invited members of public media in Juneau to a special event at the Goldtown Theater. And it was an intimate night with Modest Yahoo, a question and answer session that lasted about 45 minutes or so. And we have some highlights for that, and I'm going to play those for you now.
How did you get, like, noticed or able to perform in front of people?
Well, it was pretty noticeable, this Hasidic guy singing reggae music, and wasn't too typical, so it was easy for me to get noticed. I was into music, and then I went home to New York, and I went to college, and I became religious, and I started dressing the part as well with the hat and the suit and the beard, the yarmulke, and I moved to Crown Heights, which is a neighborhood in Brooklyn. And I studied all day long in yeshiva, Torah. And I had a friend, a rabbi, who had a a synagogue in the village in Manhattan. And I used to go see him sometimes, and sometimes we would be up on Friday nights drinking vodka late at night, and I would start rapping and beatboxing and stuff. And so he kind of knew I did it, and he was doing menorah lighting on Hanukkah in the what's called in Union Square, which is like a real busy place down in the village, and set up a huge PA system. And I brought some musicians from Crown Heights. There's like a homeless guy that played keyboards in the synagogue out front. I brought him and a kid who played the drum set, and this ragtag group of guys on the subway with our instruments, and we went to Union Square and we set everything up. And during the menorah lighting, he was kind of loud guy. He was yelling at people or just speaking loudly about Hanukkah. I think he was on a ladder. It was like a huge menorah, like obnoxiously big. And then we started playing, and I was beatboxing and singing and doing what I do. And I had my eyes closed. A lot of times I close my eyes because I get distracted by things easily. So, and then when I opened my eyes, there was literally like hundreds of people and a video camera there. And like, I think it was within weeks, I was asked to come to perform on a CNN thing because it was interesting to people. And then everything kind of happened real quick for me. So it helped being Hasidic.
Hi, I'm asking this on behalf of a friend of mine. He's a Jersey kid turned farmer.
Farmer?
In Palmer, Alaska.
Good for him.
Yeah, and he really wishes he could be here tonight. Mm. But Palmer's kind of far away. And I asked him what he would ask you if he was here. And he said, so ask Modest if God was sitting in the front row at one of his shows, which one of his songs would he dedicate to God?
Ooh. Let's see. There's four
of you. I'm not trying to be blasphemous, by the way.
Which one of you is God? Yeah, all right. I really, all my songs are kind of, I don't have one song in particular. When I'm playing music, so I sort of treat the whole experience as a spiritual event. To me, it's sort of like there was a story in the Torah of the high priest that he used to walk into the Holy of Holies, into the inner sanctuary to like pray on behalf of the community. And he would they had to tie a rope around his ankle, because if he wasn't pure, he would die, and they'd have to drag him out by a rope. It's a little dark, but my humor's a little dry, so just bear with me. And that's how I recently have started to feel like the shows to me is the music is really a holy thing, and I treat it that way, like it. The whole thing for me, the whole show for me, is like a conversation with God. I mean, I'm not always thinking about God, but I do sort of like feel that music is super holy and has like the power to really transform people and take people on a journey into themselves and expand their consciousness. And so, you know, when I'm performing music, that's kind of like my goal is always to try to have that kind of experience. And I feel that there's times when the music, you know, we improvise a lot. And when the music gets to a certain place where I'll start praying in Hebrew, because that's the language that I learned how to pray in. And I'll feel like I'm really talking to God or really expressing sort of the deepest kind of elements or aspects of my inner being to God in front of the people, you know. And I'll try to, I'm sort of like bringing people into that very intimate experience. And for me, I sort of feel like then if I feel like connected or like it's really happening, like it's working, I get like elated. I feel like really good about who I am and what I do. And when it doesn't happen, I feel like you gotta pull me out by a string. Like I feel like swallowed up by the whole situation. I get sort of overwhelmed. And when I'm in those moments and the music kind of opens up and it can go in any direction, I just start pulling lyrics from all the different songs that I've written. So, and in those moments, like everything, I become aware that all my songs are really about the same thing and they're interchangeable. The words, the lyrics, you can, you know, there's certain themes, but they all kind of relate to each other. Like it's not out of context if I pull songs from words from one song to another song and then say some lyrics from like another artist that inspired me and then pull words from the Torah or the prayers, the Psalms. It all kind of blends together into one thing. That's not really that direct of an answer, but.
So we have some students from the university here tonight, and my question for you would be, what would you recommend young people who are really interested in pursuing music as a passion or even as a part of their career? What opportunities should they pursue at this stage in their life?
If they're musicians specifically, I think the most important thing is really just to listen to music and just connect with what you love and then spend time just developing your craft, whatever it is that you do. I think it all comes from the inside out. Like a lot of people are chasing success, but I feel that when you really have something to say, and that comes from just living your life with as few crutches as possible, just experiencing the reality as it hits you, and then listening to music, the music you love, and figuring out your own voice and your own craft and how to focus on that. And then, just develop that. And then if you're going to be sick, you know, if you have what to give, then I think the universe kind of makes it happen for you.
Thanks very much. Do you mind talking a little bit about your creative process?
No, I don't mind. Live music or recording music or?
Whatever you're comfortable with. I'm more interested in the live performances myself.
Okay. When I come out on stage, I kind of am who I am, and you kind of get what you get. Like, you know, I don't really, I'm sober now at this point in my life, and a lot of artists would drink or get high before a show to get the inspiration that they need, and I don't really have that going on in my life. So I tend to be a little moody and down sometimes, and I come out on stage where I am, and if I try to pretend that I'm not that, and I get into thinking like people paid money to see this charismatic guy and I'm supposed to be something other than I am, I get depressed on stage, and that doesn't go well. So I just I come out where I'm at. I don't write a set list. I feel kind of what I look down. I have like a list of songs, or else I'll forget. I might have a list with like 50 songs on it, and I look at it right before the set, and then I come out on stage, and I just sort of, the one that calls my name, we start playing. And then we improvise. We do like, you know, the verse, chorus. And then we just open up and just see what happens with the music. And it requires a lot of listening and paying attention. And over the course of a tour, we'll sort of develop a certain sound. There'll be like certain songs that we might play more often or certain moves that we might make. But I'm always more interested in sort of not doing the thing that I know will get a reaction or that will be like good, but actually holding back from doing that and seeing what new can happen.
And that's sort of a reason. Please excuse me for interrupting the interview there with Modest Yahoo, but you can hear the rest of that or the entire question and answer session from the Gold Town Theater at ktoo.org. Look for the piece on Modest Yahoo to hear the rest of that. And a quick correction, thank you, caller. The concert does indeed start at 7:30 tonight, not 7 like I said before, And there is a wait list that's going to start at 6:30 at Centennial Hall for those that don't have tickets. And again, Nancy DeCherney said she's going to do her best to get everybody in. So our last guest here on Friday, last but certainly not least, is McKibben Jakinski. And friend Deb Rodriguez McKibben is the author of Too Close to Home, a book that came out in June of this year. She's a longtime Alaska journalist, writer. McKibben, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So you're going to be doing a signing tonight at the Downtown Hearthside Books from 5:30 to 6:30. Is that
correct?
Right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Too Close to Home. Give us, just tell us a little bit about it. Give us the back cover, if you will.
Well, the idea for the book came about in 2011 when I was reporting for the Homer News at the time, and the work was underway to bring natural gas to Homer. And I had an interview I had an opportunity to interview people that lived close to the pad where the gas was coming from. And one family who lived right across the street had a very positive experience. The father had been hired to work on the project, and that was their top priority. The family that lived right next to the pad was a very different experience. Their remote, semi-remote lifestyle had been completely destroyed by the disruption, the lights that were on 24/7, the noise that was going on, the heat from the flare that was going on, the vibration that was shaking their house. And it struck me at the time how two very different experiences being made are impacting these two families. But the decisions being made were not by them. They had nothing to do with it, and yet they were the ones being caught up in what was happening. So that stayed with me, trying to make sense out of that. And then 3 years later, in 2013, my daughters and I received a letter from one of the companies, one of the natural gas companies on the Kenai Peninsula, who wanted to lease our property. And it suddenly became very personal to us. And so as I looked around us at that time, there was a lot of activity going on. Other longtime residents whose property was being changed dramatically by drill pads going in, or neighbors who were putting up for sale signs. And it just seemed like there was a compelling story to be told and information to be shared. And so I approached Hard Scratch Press. And the editor and publisher there, Jackie Pels, immediately said, let's do the project.
And in one way or another, it would seem that all Alaskans have a relationship to oil, don't we?
Absolutely, we do, yes. Certainly, as we have seen all too clearly this last year, our budget for the state is severely dependent on oil and gas. We've really put all our eggs in one basket, and now we're feeling a $4 billion pinch because of that. But in other ways, we all benefit from the permanent fund dividend that's about to come out. So I would be hard-pressed to find somebody who isn't impacted in some way.
Do you have a selection from the book you can read for us?
I'd love to, yes.
Please do.
Outside my cabin window this October afternoon, the view is of birch trees, their limbs stripped of golden leaves now that another fall is passing and winter looms. These trees have borne witness to my family's presence on the planet. Along with deep green spruce and rough bark cottonwood, they have stood sentry over the births of new generations and the passing of elders, over our prosperity and our poverty, our joys and heartbreaks. They have absorbed carefree laughter and voices raised in anger, lent their strength to children's swings, and when the cycle of earth has brought them to earth, filled our stoves, warmed our cabins, produced blazing campfires to light the darkness. Today's scene reminds me to look not with a limited vision of my eyes, but with a future-seeing, hopeful gaze of my heart. Once green leaves carpet the ground to become another layer in the soil. Cottony fluffs of fireweed seeds hug tall, skeletal stalks and then are carried off in the wind. The musky scent of highbush cranberries floods the air with the message that now is the time to harvest. Be steadfast, the chilly morning air tells me. The fullness of life will come again. The transformation from summer's bounty to winter's barrenness is simply a step in a cycle. Rebirth will come once winter has passed and the northern hemisphere tips again toward the warmth of the sun. However, another sort of energy has found its way to my front door. The growing momentum to discover additional oil and natural gas fields.
cleaner energy than the wind from these from these forests and coal from these beaches. Cheaper energy than the heating oil delivered by fuel trucks. Testing might discover it's here beneath my feet. It could, as it has for neighbors to the north, provide a source of income beyond what I thought this land could provide. It could change everything. All I need to do is what I'm told my neighbors have done. Sign this piece of paper and then step aside as the land that has been in my family for generations becomes unalterably changed into an unavailable, unfit, non-existent haven for future generations.
Thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
Would you say that that style is indicative of the rest of the book?
Well, that particular portion of the book is fairly personal. And the personal part, my family's story and our decision on whether or not to lease to this company, is woven throughout the book, as well as our history in Alaska. My family dates back to one of the first families in Inilchik. But it weaves around interviews of other people and who have experienced both pro and con, what their interaction with oil and gas has meant. There's also a chapter that's directly ties to interviews with our elected officials at both the city of Homer level as well as the Kenai Peninsula Borough, and then also our legislative representatives. And then there's a chapter that's just all with energy experts and asking them what our level of energy consumption is, what determines how eagerly we use that or when we cut back. And So that section stands out as being fairly personal, and it's not all that way.
Okay. But it sounds like that is sort of the vehicle to get you through the interviews.
Yes.
Interesting. A bit memoir, a bit creative journalism, creative nonfiction. It seems like a nice hybrid of those styles.
Thank you. I hope it reads that way.
Okay. I wish we had more time to keep going, but if somebody wants to meet you or get a signed copy, they can come to Hearthside Books tonight. Is that right?
Yes, please stop by.
5:30 to 6:30. Any sort of last thoughts, sort of what you're most proud of with the book? It must feel so good to be done. You said it's a three-year project.
Three-year project, but the most, and the goal of it was just to open up discussion. You know, certainly we don't all view the topic the same way, but it calls for discussion, and so that's what I hope it will spark.
All right. Good art usually does. Thank you so much for coming on the show, author McKibben Jakinski. She'll be down at Hearthside tonight, 5:30 to 6:30. Thank you.
Come on down to Boogie for the Bayou, a benefit for Louisiana Flood Relief, sponsored by the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, featuring an Alaska Cajun seafood feed with Oku salmon, rockfish, oysters, and all the fixings. Beer in Sazerac Garden with live music from Juneau's own North Country Cajun Club and Gamble's High Cost of Lovin'. Saturday, September 24th at the Yacht Club. Tickets online at the Jack and Hearthside Books. Get on down for a good cause, y'all.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. On Monday, I'll be your host again, and we'll get the details about this weekend's next weekend's Black and White Gala fundraiser for the Bartlett Foundation. We'll find out about master planning meetings for Parks and Rec, and we'll learn how you can make artist trading cards and meet some exchange students from Palestine, Istanbul, and Gaza. The forecast for tonight calls for showers, lows around 44. Tomorrow, Saturday, showers, highs around 53.